Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We are moving towards feeding back into the grid power which had been on the export market. Cabinet reached this decision arising out of the national disaster and emergency situation that was declared by the President Hakainde Hichilema.
Zambia's government promises citizens that the ongoing load shedding will significantly reduce soon.
This time around, we thought that an opportunity has arisen, of course, through a third way, but we still felt that it was going now to ensure that there's a vice president that is a woman. So for me, I think it's a lost opportunity. Maybe he has his own reasons why he has chosen that way, but in terms of the gender agenda, for me, I think it's a lost opportunity.
Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera appoints a new vice president. We'll have a reaction.
The establishment of the court is not to witch hunt anybody, but it is purposely intended to ensure that accountability and justice is afforded to people first time in their life since the cessation of the civil crisis. With people who will be indicted by the court when and if the court is set up, will have a fair day in court.
And Liberia's President Joseph Boakai appoints a well-known lawyer as the executive director of the Office of War and Economic Crimes Court. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Zambia, the country's information minister and chief government spokesperson is promising citizens that the ongoing load shedding will significantly reduce soon. This, Cornelius Mwitua says, is due to a cabinet decision to recall 100 megawatts of power from the export market for local use. His remarks come after the Zambians called on the government to address ongoing regular power blackout, which they say is affecting businesses. The information minister also denied criticism that the government is using the police to prevent opposition parties from holding rallies. In a wide-ranging interview with me, Cornelius Mwitua also defended President Hakainde Hichilema's recent trip to the United Kingdom and why he missed the installation of South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. Here is part one of the conversation.
The government yesterday made a decision through cabinet to recall the power that it is exporting to the region. It has so far resolved to recall 100 megawatts with the 19 still under negotiation by the National Utility Electricity Company, ZESCO, Zambia Electricity Supply Corporation. And so that means that if the full 195 is recalled, 195 megawatts, it means that we are moving towards feeding back into the grid power which had been on the export market. And the cabinet reached this decision arising out of the national disaster and emergency situation that was declared by the President Hakainde Hichilema on 29th April 2024.
What impact do you anticipate this recall of such an amount of energy to have on businesses and the general population in Zambia?
Well, the impact, first of all, I wanted to indicate that additional to that recall, the government yesterday resolved working with Ndola Energy, which has not been producing power because it has not had the feedstock requisite for as fuel of the production of electricity after the closure of the oil refinery in Beni. The government decided to open up and reserve part of the fuel that is coming into the country to be fed to this Ndola Energy company to begin to produce within this week 105 megawatts of power. So you can add up the 195 and 105, it will go to about 300 megawatts of power if the recall is full, which will go towards mitigating the about 800 electricity deficit situation in the country, before we talk about some of the mini stations of solar that are coming through, and also investments in the thermal power production. So it is anticipated that with this recall of power, there should be a reduction, firstly, in load shedding of power to the citizenry, and secondly, in terms of the available power to be utilized by industry, given that industry has suffered inadvertently and consequently affecting the economy.
In the long term, Mr. Muitua, what is the plan to eliminate load shedding in Zambia? Because your critics are saying in the opposition, some of you accused previous government and the former government of incompetence and poor leadership, which you said led to unsustainable power rationing or load shedding. So what is different this time?
First of all, it has to be understood quite clearly that the power situation we find ourselves in today is as a result of climate change challenges, and in this particular regard, to do with the drought. That is the challenge which we are faced with as a country. And this is not the only problem, the drought. The issue is that climate change effects have been anticipated on the global stage, particularly on low-developing countries such as those in the sub-Saharan Africa. Yet successive governments, in the case of Zambia, have been aware of the anticipated and imminent coming of the effects of climate change, yet no investments in alternative and sustainable sources of energy were made by successive governments. And therefore, where we are now should not be, in fact, lumped on our government as being inept or failing to handle the situation. We actually are in a space where we are saying this administration is handling this situation with the expediency of the moment, to ensure that this situation does not spiral out of context and doesn't get out of hand. And that is why you have seen the magnanimity of this administration to renegotiate contracts that were signed decades ago between Zambia and other member countries in the Southern Africa power pool, where even in the midst of drought, poor rains, you continue to export power to the region as a matter of contractual obligation.
Cornelius Muitua is Zambia's Information Minister and Chief Government Spokesperson. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. In South Africa, the first granddaughter of Nelson Mandela says she is cautiously optimistic that the government of national unity will meet the aspiration of voters. Nleka Mandela also says the performance of the African National Congress, or the ANC, was due to what she says was the refusal of a majority of South African voters to maintain confidence in the party. Her remarks come after the ANC agreed to form a government of national unity with the main opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA, the Inkatha Freedom Party, and the Patriotic Alliance. For more information about her assessment and expectations of the government of national unity, I reach Nleka Mandela.
So this is not the first time we've formed the government of national unity. If you remember, with our first democratic dispensation, we did form a government of national unity, where the two vice presidents, Bin Tuitek and Thabo Mbeki. However, things are not the same as they were in 1994, because at the time, we were not forced into a coalition like we have been right this time around. Not forced as such, but we did get a majority This time we did not get a majority, and to form a government we needed to have a majority, which is why, you know, certain parties were approached to form the government of national unity.
Some people even are suggesting that previously in 1994, the ANC negotiated or went into a government of national unity from a position of strength. This time around, it's the opposite. Yes. It went into it with a really weakened position.
Yes, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that.
What are your expectations of this government of national unity?
Well, you know, it's going to be a fine balancing act, because when I look at the history of the DA in Cape Town, you know, they haven't improved where black people are staying. In Nyanga, Kukuletu, Ogalanga, they've only improved things where white people stay. So I'm cautiously optimistic with what's going to happen this time around, because I don't think the DA has the interests of black people at heart, seeing it what they've done in Cape Town, in the Western Cape.
What do you say to those who are of the opinion that the ANC has itself to blame by failing to meet the aspirations of the people and failing on providing service delivery that contributed to its gradual decline?
I totally agree. I mean, you must know of my history of being scathing towards the ruling party. You know, and this was a disaster waiting to happen. When year in, year out, there's no service delivery. If I have to look at the Eastern Cape, for instance, which is my own province, there are still children that cross swollen rivers with no bridges. When there is money to build bridges, money is returned to the fiscus every year. And the thing is, the ANC did not lose because people didn't vote for them. They lost because people simply stayed away from the polls. If you look at the percentage of the polls, I mean, it's 58% of the people that registered to vote, which means a big chunk of them, 42%, 38% didn't vote. You know, and I do believe that they have only themselves to blame. Yes, I do understand that, you know, undoing the damage of apartheid, which was a regime over a century, in a short space of 30 years, has been difficult. However, I do believe there are areas where they could have improved. There are areas that they could have done better. For instance, the ruling party has done well in terms of electrification in the entire South Africa.
Some are suggesting that perhaps the involvement of the Democratic Alliance could act as a check on the ANC and vice versa. What are your thoughts?
I highly doubt that. If they could check the purse strings, you know, they could have distributed the wealth equally in the Western Cape, which they haven't done. So I still do believe they will look after their own interests. You know, time will tell whether they would be able to advance the agenda of every South African, not agenda of their own, and correct the imbalances of the past. Because certainly in the Western Cape, they haven't done that.
Do you think the ANC, and for that matter, leaders of the ANC, are living to the expectations of your grandfather, President Mandela?
Well, you know, it's a hard question, because to have like a crystal glass and say this is what my grandfather would say, I would be lying. All I can say is according to what he said with his own mouth, that if the ANC does what the apartheid government did, we must vote them out of office, which the people have done.
So the people basically followed his direction, even though he's long gone.
I would say yes. I mean, if you gather by the majority of the people, like I said, that the ANC did not lose because people didn't vote for them. They lost because people simply stayed away from the polls. The bulk of the people that registered to vote didn't go and vote.
Nleka Mandela is the first granddaughter of Nelson Mandela. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Malawi, the founder and executive director of Women's Legal Resource Center says President Lazarus Chakwera's appointment of Michael Usi as the new vice president is a lost opportunity to promote gender equality. Maggie Kathawera Banda, who is also the chairperson of the NGO Gender Coordinating Network, says the president should have appointed a woman to the post in an effort to empower women. The president chose Usi, who until his appointment was Minister of Natural Resources and Climate Change. He replaces Vice President Salos Chilima, who recently died in a plane crash. Local media say Catholic bishops, traditional chiefs, and the United Transformation Party, or UTM, are happy with the appointment. But Maggie Kathawera Banda explains to me about why, in her view, the president should have made a different choice.
For me, I think it's a lost opportunity in terms of promoting gender equality, because we felt that this time around the president was at liberty now to choose someone that can now become a vice president. Because I think at the time that we were going for elections in 2020, because of the situation that we're in, there was a limitation, I think, in terms of who he could choose as a running mate. But this time around, we thought that an opportunity has arisen, of course, through a sad way, but we still felt that it was going now to ensure that there's a vice president that is a woman. So for me, I think it's a lost opportunity. Maybe he has his own reasons why he has chosen that way, but in terms of the gender agenda, for me, I think it's a lost opportunity.
There's a school of thought that the president's choices were limited because as a leader of the MCP, the Malawi Congress Party, he went to an alliance with the UTM that formed the Tonse Alliance that won. So he was limited to choose somebody within that parameter.
So for me, to say that he's limited because he was supposed to look within the alliance, that doesn't really hold water, because within the alliance itself, there are women that we thought he could settle for. So, for example, like the UTM party itself, which was the main alliance partner, we have capable women in the choices of, for example, Nyalonje, who is the cabinet minister already, people like Vera Kantukule, for example. So for me, I think having this argument to stay within the Tusk alliance was limited choice. I don't think that's the right direction that I would also go for.
Well, Maggie, talking about the women agenda in Malawi, the president, his supporters often say that has been a champion on advocating for women. He's had women in his cabinet and in higher public institutions where decisions are made. So his choice of a new vice president being described as a lost opportunity, his supporters are saying it's not fair. How do you respond to that?
Okay, all right. So, yeah, I think I should commend the president that indeed he has chosen women in two high positions. But still, we felt that even having a woman at the president's level would actually give the maximum maybe visibility to say this is what I mean when I talk about empowering women in two positions. So much as we have female cabinet ministers, much as we have the secretary of the president, who is a female, we have the inspector general, who is female, but we still felt that even at presidential level, if we can have a woman, that would also show the highest commitment from the president himself in terms of empowering women, but also in terms of believing in the gender agenda, but also in terms of believing in the Gender Equality Act that we have in Malawi. Because we have a Gender Equality Act that also stipulates in terms of how public appointments are supposed to be handled. Because it says that in any public appointment, they should not be more than 60% and not less than 40% of either sex. So we felt that even at presidential level, if we can have a balance in terms of gender, that would give a very good example to all entities in Malawi to say, this is what I mean when I talk about gender equality.
People have mentioned the former anti-corruption bureau head, who was a female. You had a former president who was a female. So talking about women empowerment, they said Malawi has had its fair share of robust women empowerment. It's just that, Maggie, they said, you just want more.
No, we want more. And then I don't also understand why we have to negotiate for the same, because I really feel that women as citizens have a right to participate in decision-making processes that affect their lives. So for me, I think I really don't understand why people have to say, okay, for women, you have to negotiate. For women, you have to show why we have to put you in position. When we are citizens, we are voters, our voices also need to matter, even in terms of decisions. So much as our votes count when we are voting. The voices also of the women have to count when decisions are being made for the country. And that's what we're saying, that even at the highest level where decisions are made, because the president is the highest authority. So even at that highest authority level, we need voices of women. So for me, I really feel it's unfair where women are expected to negotiate, where women are expected to justify why they need to be chosen into positions.
Maggie Kathawera Banda is the founder and executive director of Women's Legal Resource Center. She spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Liberia's President Joseph Boakai has appointed well-known lawyer Jonathan Masakoi as the executive director of the Office of War and Economic Crimes Court. It comes weeks after the president issued an executive order to establish the court in Liberia. Proponents of the court say, once set up, it will help combat corruption and end impunity, including for human rights abuses and crimes committed during the country's civil wars. To learn more about his vision and plans following his appointment, I reach attorney Jonathan Masakoi.
You may be aware that since the cessation of the hostility in Liberia that brought on those suffering to the Liberian people, there have been two successive governments who probably may have dodged the issue of the establishment of the World Economic Crown Court. So this Joseph Boakai administration has the courage and took the bold steps to establish the court so that Liberia can experience justice and accountability first time in their life, because you know the issue of the World Economic Crown Court is an issue of novelty. It's strange to this country. And so that we can also address the issue of the culture of impunity that have bedeviled this country. Because, you know, since the crisis, there is this bitterness in the country. The country is divided. The country is what it is. So with the establishment of the World Economic Crown Court and the Anti-Corruption Court, that will bring some sense of national healing and reconciliation to this country. And by that, it will trigger the issue of development, peace and stability in Liberia and the sub-region.
Jonathan, you talked about reconciliation and addressing impunity and corruption, among others. What do you say to those who are of the opinion that perhaps this office and the court would be used to settle personal scores or those who are critics of the administration?
Well, Peter Clotier, I can assure you there will be no issue of witch hunting in this country. The establishment of the court is not to witch hunt anybody, but it is purposely intended to ensure that accountability and justice is afforded Liberian people first time in their life since the cessation of the civil crisis. And with people who will be indicted by the court when and if the court is set up, will have a fair day in court. And so the issue of due process will also be taken into consideration. So there will be no issue of witch hunting. Well, the court, you know, it will be a UN-backed court, international court, and we understand that the international instrument, the Geneva Convention, the Hague Convention, and the Hague Convention and the Genocidal Convention, all of those instruments, the Rome Statute, the international customary laws will all be used to afford these people justice so that they can have their fair day in court, coupled with our domestic laws. So there'll be no reason we can assure you that.
President Boakai's efforts have been praised. Also, Congressman Chris Smith of the U.S. and a friend of Liberia, Dr. Alan White, have been praised with their effort. Some people are suggesting that perhaps there should also be advisors from the international community to help with this court to address this transparently. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so it's obvious, like I said, the court will be a UN-backed court, right? You know that the national legislature has passed a resolution, joint resolution. The president has signed an executive order. The president has also appointed the executive director to keep this thing going, to have this court stood up and operational. And so the international experts that will come, we will also be working assiduously to ensure that there will be no violation or infringement of people's rights. Those who will be indicted, if and when the court is stood up, will be accorded a fair day in court, right? And so we can only say the coming of the international expert to support our efforts is in a positive direction. And that's what we all yearn for as Liberians.
Within the first 100 days of your appointment, what do you think you would want to achieve? And what expectations do you want the people of Liberia to have of you following your appointment?
So in the first 100 days, you know that the the issue of the office of the executive director is to ensure the setting out of the court to facilitate the establishment of the One Economic Crown Court and the Anti-Corruption Court. Another aspect is outrage. You know, like I said, the issue of the One Economic Crown is a novelty. It's strange to the justice system in Liberia, and so you have to ensure that the people information is disseminated so that the people can understand what is about to take place in Liberia, so they can appreciate, like I said, so they can experience justice for themselves. So within the first 100 days, we're going to be working very hard to find office space, making sure we identify our staff, skeleton staff, keep the ball rolling, and formulate a budget. Also, we're going to be working very hard to disseminate the information as to the establishment of the court. And so we're also going to be doing investigation, researching, and also trying to identify source of funding for the court so as to not experience what happened in Sierra Leone, right? So that will be our main focus within the first 100 days.
Jonathan Masakoi is the newly appointed executive director of the Office of War and Economic Crimes Court. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. In Kenya, parliamentarians have approved a finance bill which seeks to raise $2.7 billion in additional taxes. Local media reports a nationwide protest against the measure, which many say will worsen the already high cost of living. At least one person was killed and 200 others were injured when police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the protesters, many of them the country's youth. Called Gen Z, the youth organized themselves using social media to kick against the finance bill. Nyawanga Owor is a social activist, a law student, and a representative of the Light Art Club, the biggest youth society and platform in Africa. She tells me that she is proud of their message to the government, showing their power in spite of the approval of the finance bill.
I think I'm speaking on behalf of many young people when I say that the bill passing in parliament, unfortunately, is not shocking, right? We come from a society where our politics is very heavily governed by, one, our tribal lines, and two, according to the power of the pocket feeding into you, if you get what I mean. So our agenda today protesting, as much as our main aim was to reject the bill, I think a big aim of ours was just to make sure that our voice is heard and that our current regime knows the power that we hold.
Some critics or supporters of the government are saying that the effort and the protest basically is it's a wasted opportunity and resources that the country does not have. How do you respond to that?
One thing that must be very, very well and duly noted about the 2024 protests among the Gen Z is that we were not funded by any government representative. We were not funded by any member of parliament. Some members of parliament tried to reach out to us and say, can we sponsor this element, that element of the protest? We said, no, we don't want your money, because as soon as political money and government money starts entering these protests, I think the agenda gets swayed and the integrity of it is lost. So I don't think it's a waste of resources. I also do not think it was a waste of time or energy. Yes, the bill was passed. Yes, it has gone to the next stage. But the outfall of it is a completely different perspective to how the Gen Zs are looked at in society. For a long time, Gen Zs have been looked at as lazy, as rambunctious, as they want quick money, they don't fight for what they believe in. This is the first time people have said, oh, come on, Gen Zs have a voice. I didn't know that Gen Zs were this powerful. So it has shifted the conversation and the perspective of Gen Zs. It has unified young people and made them realize that we can be heard.
Where do you go from here for Gen Zs? Because in spite of your effort, this is moving on.
Well, first of all, I am aware that there is plans to continue protest, not just Nairobi, but countrywide. If you ask me from the deepest point of my heart, these protests perhaps might not result in the finance bill being thrown out. The point where we have reached, it is very likely that it will lead to presidential assent. That's okay. We will have to deal with the situation as it is. But that doesn't mean we've stepped down. It doesn't mean we've gone silent. I think a lot of young people who did not vote in the 2022 election but have the ability to have realized, oh my gosh, I made a mistake by not doing my civic duty. So it has led to a lot of things. It has led to a lot of people realizing the importance of their vote, the importance of social media, because remember, our protests were completely mobilized for on TikTok, on Instagram, on Twitter. And one thing we talk about when it comes to the internet is the internet never forgets. We have a public list of our members of parliament that voted for us and against us. We will not forget. The 2027 election is not far away. If you have decided that you are going to eat well for the next 3 years and throw away the rest of your political career, that is the decision that you made today, and the consequences will come in the next 3 years.
Is this what Kenyans should expect from Gen Z?
I think Kenyans, especially the older generation of Kenyans, should not be scared of Gen Z, should not be scared of Gen Z's power, should not be scared that we will protest at the smallest inconvenience. I think we're still an extremely resilient group of people, as I'm sure you saw in the footage. You're being tear gassed, you're being thrown at itching powder, and we're getting back up and saying, you know what, continue. So they should not be afraid of us, but I like to hope that they are proud of us, in the sense that I come from a background where preserving the status quo was the most important thing you could do. Don't question authority, it's a sign of disrespect. Don't ask why your rights are being infringed, it's a sign of disrespect. The generations that came before us were very, I don't use the word submissive, but they played by the rules. You know what I mean? We are the first generation of people that, because of the networks we have formed, the ease of communication, the way we have managed to raise our own intellect and share wisdom, we are the most informed, most intelligent, and most able generation of people. So yes, we plan to continue to being outside. We plan to continue speaking up for ourselves, not just for the finance bill, but for every policy in which we are not involved in. Because I will remind you that one of the major aspects that is important for a bill to pass in Kenya is some level of public participation. This is a bill that majorly affects the youth, and the youth make up of 70% of Kenya's population. There was no public participation. There was no question. We were never brought to the table. We were never asked, what are your ideas? What are your plans? So for as long as we are not heard, for as long as we are not given an opportunity to speak, we will take that opportunity for ourselves, even if it means in the street.
Nyawanga Owuor is a social activist, a law student, and a representative of the Light Art Club. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music from our African collection of music from the continent. But first, foreign direct investment to Africa fell by 3% to $53 billion in 2023, according to the UN's Trade and Development Agency report released Thursday. However, Africa received more than $10 billion for wind and solar electricity production, with the latest projects located in Egypt, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. The report says financial conditions are expected to ease this year, but countries must improve their transparency to benefit from foreign investment. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Foreign direct investment to Africa fell by 3% to $53 billion in 2023, according to the UN's Trade and Development Agency report released Thursday. However, Africa received more than $10 billion for wind and solar electricity production, with the largest projects located in Egypt, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. The report says financial conditions are expected to ease this year, but countries must improve their transparency to benefit from foreign investment. Mohammed Yusuf reports, Africa became less attractive to foreign investors last year, and finance deals declined by 50% to $64 billion, according to a new report. The World Investment Report released by the UN Trade and Development Agency said foreign investment remains subdued by the global economic slowdown and rising geopolitical tensions. On the continent, Central African countries recorded the largest drop, 17%, and West Africa recorded the lowest dip, 1%. Bruce Nsereko Lule is a general partner at Seed Stars Africa Ventures, a venture capital firm that invests in high-growth companies. He says the economic situation in Western countries has contributed to the reduction in foreign direct investment in Africa.
We have seen very high interest rates in Western economies with the devaluation of currency that we saw. This is partially driven by the same factor. Investments in these developing markets, emerging markets, even became less attractive, as the companies effectively had to work significantly hard to generate a return that would make a good return for the Western investors.
Researchers say that the lack of financial inflows to Africa and other countries affected sustainable development, with new funding dropping by 10% globally. Lack of financing for development programs will hinder countries from achieving the 2030 agenda, which covers economic growth, social inclusion, and environmental protection. The reduction of foreign investments is blamed on protectionist policies by African governments and regional alignments, which investigators say are disrupting the world economy, fragmenting trade networks, regulatory environments, and global supply chains. Some governments' actions have undermined the stability and predictability of global investment flows, creating obstacles and isolating opportunities. Samuel Nyandemo, economics lecturer at the University of Nairobi, says the behavior of some African governments is turning away investors.
There is corruption, there is bureaucracy in the investments, the red tape bureaucracies, and then the marginal rates of returns from investments are not forthcoming.
The fall of foreign direct investment in Africa is blamed on insecurity in some African countries, the weakening of local currencies, a harsh business environment, corruption, and political uncertainty. However, Africa has received investment in growing share of greenfield mega projects worth $5 billion, wind and solar energy production worth $10 billion, and Morocco, a North African nation, is getting $6.5 billion to manufacture electric vehicle batteries. Nyandemo says Africa needs to create an environment where investors feel safe with their businesses.
They need to enhance investor confidence, create a conducive macroeconomic environment for investments, and enable investors to repatriate their profits appropriately without any bureaucratic procedures, and minimize taxation, create a tax regime which is conducive for investment.
The UN report predicts that despite ongoing challenges, financial conditions in Africa are expected to improve. Governments can address low investments by creating transparent and streamlined business environments. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
The city of Limbe is a cosmopolitan center for tourism in Cameroon's western region. Formerly known as Victoria during the colonial era, it is an Anglophone part of the country, which historians say is known for its peace and black sand beaches. It is currently hosting many internally displaced persons who have been affected by the ongoing conflict between government forces and separatists. John Manga Williams, the paramount chief of Limbe, is currently in the U.S., where he has been meeting Cameroonians in the diaspora about peace and his development plans back home, among other key issues. I sat down with the paramount chief and discussed wide-ranging issues including peace, stability, women's empowerment and development in his kingdom as well as in Cameroon. Here is part one of the conversation.
I think I might not be exaggerating that this town was founded by a missionary. So the basis of its existence is on the Christian platform. And so you cannot minimize that aspect. It has a strong Christian background. And even after that, we also call it the town of friendship and many opportunities. So if you come there with trouble, you definitely not find a mate, a friend to make trouble with. And so you definitely align with those who have come to explore the opportunities that are there. And there are so many opportunities. We know we can boast of the sea, the sandy beaches, everything is there for you to make a livelihood. And so why do you want to come in with trouble? So everybody resorts to coming there and you always find a place to stay, you always find what to eat, a profession to possibly execute. If you're a civil servant, you will not mind, you will not always have any challenge to find job opportunities, or as a businessman. Every small thing pays, every little thing pays. So I think that's a safe haven. And with this crisis that we're having in the North and Southwest, everybody thinks that they can best continue their lives in Limbe.
What accounts for the attractiveness of the kingdom to tourism? A lot of youth in Africa say there are no jobs. Sometimes they blame the government, sometimes they blame traditional leaders. As a paramount chief, what are you doing specifically to help promote the environment for investors, to create the job, the needed environment for the youth to get job, so they will not cause trouble anywhere else, let alone your kingdom?
Yeah, thank you. I think what you've just asked has a response from three different stakeholders. We're talking about the government, we're talking about the local administration, and we're talking about the traditional authority. It is not possible for the government to create a job for everybody. Mm-hmm. There are, of course, avenues that are open for everybody to create job on his own or her own. Same with the local authority. It is not possible, but I know that at the level of these two previous structures, they are flexible about opening of business or running of businesses that can sustain you and sustain your family. The corporations that we have, the CDC and Sonara, they can't take everybody. So what we try to do is to get a data bank of who are qualified. And when they need camps, we make sure that such information is furnished to the employers. And we work with other employment organizations, like we have the National Employment Fund that carries out the formation and the employment of youths. Now, at our own level, we try to, and what we are doing presently, we try to create a vocational training center. Mm. You know, so many of these youths who are coming from without, they don't have skills. They come from villages and other towns that they were just living their lives. So we want to train them in a skill even within the shortest possible period. You know, so we have a vocational training center. We are undergoing the process of registration so that the certificates will be recognized. Because there are so many opportunities, especially in the business of restoration. Mm-hmm. And we also want to create, we have the sea, which is large, so many opportunities there, to create a CIG, Common Initiative Group, that will take care of the young men who can go to sea, fish, or buy the products from the sea. We have a lot of smoked fish that is being exported, not only within Cameroon, but out of Cameroon. Mm. So those are opportunities that we also try to inform them that they should be involved in businesses that can pay them and pay the family. I think we are really succeeding. So that aside, we also do a lot of assistance. At the level of the social amenities that we have, we want to get them involved in community development. Mm.
John Manga Williams is the paramount chief of Limbe in Cameroon. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Come for new in Tula, Mabuli and Boos. Boos is angry. He's on the Zibera Zamuquano.
zate banjawe onyise tunguba usungu bunji nawe sara pulesa nawe ugenda kweta zate banjawe.
I want baby, why? what you want, baby. Drop it down, baby. Show me you want to see. A little pop up, mama. I said one, baby.
You shake it,
drop it down, baby.
You shake it,
show me you want to see. Ali choku pa mama, o pensile tu moto, amoto moto be, lila wanguza, amoto moto, I say baby white a fire, na wachoma buba, amoto moto, moto.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer the effervescent Tiang Wang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you break every relationship you have with someone who says something bad about you, you are going to be eating dinner alone. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.